Thank you for listening to this gospel resource from Cornerstone Baptist Church in Wylie, Texas. Feel free to use or share this resource, but we ask that you not alter the content in any way. For more information about Cornerstone Baptist Church, please visit us at cornerstonewylie.org.
All right, today we're going to focus on the English Reformation, which means we are moving off of the continent of Europe where we came from last week. So if you will trace this whole all the way back to the beginning of our study on church history, we started in the Fertile Crescent in the middle of the Middle East there. We branched out throughout the Middle East over to Greece into Italy and Rome, back over to Constantinople, back over to Rome, then north up into the mainland Europe. The church, the Great Schism, goes east to the Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox territories over in that direction, while the Roman Catholic Church continues northward and westward into mainland Europe and across the channel into England. So we're slowly making our way globally around the earth from the church itself. And today we're moving from mainland Europe into the British Isles. But before we turn our attention fully away from mainland Europe and to the English Reformation, I want to give a very brief word on sort of what became of the Catholic Church. And by the way, if you don't have it, I did provide once again and my entire generosity to you a printout. It was on the back chair back there. I'm sure it's elsewhere now. There's more over here. I labor very diligently on those things. And at the very least, at the very end, you know, we're going to read something together, so you'll want to have that in front of you, or else, you know, your neighbor will make fun of you for not being able to read along, and they're not going to want to share with you anyway. So I'll give you a chance to get up and pass those out and have those in front of you, taking copious notes, I'm sure, throughout the entire time. No. But like I said, we're moving from Western Europe into mainland or the Isles of England. But before we get there, I want to talk about what happened to the Catholic Church. We know, since we see it around us even today, that the Catholic Church still exists. It has a pope, there are bishops, there are priests, and frankly, it has gained even more popularity in recent years. If you've been paying attention to some of this right now, the Catholic Church has seen a renewed interest, especially within some of the younger generations. I think that's probably largely a generational reaction against some of the lack of formalism brought by evangelicalism. That's a really interesting study for us to have at another time, but that's a later discussion. That's not my focus here. I just want to point out that the Catholic Church does, in fact, exist still today, and it has survived. Even after last week's Reformation discussion, that Catholic Church takes on a new angle. We looked a couple weeks ago at the conciliar movement that sought to rein in the power of the papacy of the Catholic Church by subjecting it to a council, and that was going to create probably about 300 years worth of machinations within the Catholic Church to engage in some level of reform. And there were other reforms that took place even at the time of the Protestant Reformation in mainland Europe, areas of like Spain and Portugal and places like that where they had their own Catholic Reformations. But there was one reform effort in the Catholic Church that I really want to mention before, and I'm just kind of glancing on this to move on to the English Reformation, but it bears mentioning here. And that's the Council of Trent. Pope Paul III called for the council in 1545, which, if you're tracking with me, that's roughly 15 years after the signing of the Augsburg Confession. So within Luther's lifetime, there is some vindication for his efforts. And I think that's the first observation to make about the Council of Trent. If the Pope felt the need to define further the Catholic Church or provide for its formal reform less than two decades after the Augsburg Confession, I think Luther probably should just stand up and take a bow. I mean, he brought the worldwide church to a halt to say we need to figure out how to better define ourselves against these upstart Protestants. Surely he and others deserve some credit for bringing the Council of Trent even into existence. Well, the council meets from roughly 1545 until 1563. Apparently nothing gets settled quickly when it comes to councils and church conferences and that sort of thing. You think our business meetings are long? I mean, imagine going on for 25 years and trying to do these things, like the Council of Trent, as well as we're going to see today the Westminster Confession. Well, it addressed many issues, such as regulating indulgences and relics. Again, I think Luther should take a bow again. That's one of the things he railed against. Founding seminaries for the training of the priesthood. They hadn't had any of those, apparently, thus far. They wanted to focus specifically on that. And then also promoting Thomas Aquinas as the dominant strand of theology for the church, which, you know, not terribly a bad thing for the Catholics to be able to do. And there were specific issues that it took to define the Catholic Church as distinct from the rising Protestant Church, and those were where we see the most trouble. Rather, they confess sola scriptura with the reformers. The Council of Trent elevates tradition on the same level as Holy Scripture. Instead of recognizing sola gratia or sola fide, by grace alone, through faith alone, the Council of Trent held that justification is based upon good works done in coordination between grace and the believer. As to solus Christus, Christ alone, the Council of Trent recognizes that the Mass is a true sacrifice that can be offered for the benefit of the dead, and that communion is unnecessary for the laity. And again, distinction from the once and for all time sacrifice of Christ on the cross that the Protestants would proclaim and we would hold today. They also rejected the efforts of men like Wycliffe and Tyndale, and the Council of Trent declares instead the Latin Vulgate would be the authoritative translation of the scriptures in matters of dogma. That's not a horrible thing, but again, they're removing the actual scriptures from the native tongues of the people who would be otherwise reading it. So the Council of Trent marks both the birth of the modern Catholic Church, and it also buries the Catholic Church that Luther, the medieval Catholic Church that Luther and others had protested. So today, the Catholic Church still recognizes and still affirms the Council of Trent, even if Vatican II in the 1960s attempted to create a little bit of room within for Protestant cooperation with the Catholic Church, some ecumenism within the Catholic Church. It's still official policy. All the anathemas, all the affirmations that were held in the in the Council of Trent, that is still what is held by today's Catholic Church. So while Luther is justified that reforms were in fact needed and they came to the Catholic Church by way of the Council of Trent, those anathemas, those affirmations offered by the Council of Trent more clearly define the Catholic Church away from Protestantism rather than where they really needed the reform, towards Protestant. And I'll say this, and this is probably the boldest statement I'll make on this topic. The Council of Trent not only rejected Protestantism, I think they argued in favor of a different gospel altogether. And so that's, again, a different discussion for the idea of Catholicism generally, but I wanted it for the purposes of church history to at least define that there is a greater schism than even the one that took place between the Eastern and the Western churches. There is a turn away from biblical Christianity and affirming, even to this day, 400, 500 years later, a doctrine that you and I would not recognize. So with that brief interregnum over, we'll turn to the English Reformation. Well, like the Protestant Reformation, the English Reformation unfortunately did not occur with a flip of a switch, right? This takes place over about 100 years it took to evolve on the British Isles. But the leaping off point was at least a little bit more salacious and perhaps entertaining than, you know, Luther walking to the church door at Wittenberg and nailing 95 theses against it. The launching point for the English Reformation quite literally springs from the loins of Henry VIII. If you can rattle off the many merry wives of Henry VIII, good for you. You're an Anglophile among Anglophiles. I don't remember all of them, and it's not important for us to be able to rattle them all off in succession here, but what most of us will remember is the basics, right? Henry could not produce a male heir, or at least a legitimate male heir to the throne, and England would not recognize at the time a female in the line of succession, which ironically, it's going to soon essentially be forced to do so, even from Henry VIII. Nevertheless, Henry VIII wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. The problem was he was married to Catherine of Aragorn, and in order to be able to marry one and get rid of the other, he had to do something about that. That was either going to have to divorce Catherine of Aragorn, which the church was not going to recognize and allow. So he decided to ask the Pope to simply annul the marriage, you know, just to act as if it had never occurred, that there were no carnal relations, nothing. It just didn't exist. Well, this the Pope was not willing to do. So to get his way, Henry instead decides that he would just simply launch a brand new church. Pretty entrepreneurial of him. It seems like it makes a lot of sense to get to his point. And this is going to be the Church of England, or what would be called the Anglican Church. So don't forget, Henry VIII was the first to bear the title Defender of the Faith. And so this is a guy that, yeah, he had his peccadillos, he had his problems, and I wouldn't hold him out as an example of moral virtue by any stretch. But at one point, Pope Leo X gave him that title, Defender of the Faith, in large measure because Henry published a treatise against Luther, whom he called a poisonous serpent and a wolf of hell. So Pope Leo X likes the fact that Henry VIII is doing that, and so he bestows upon him the title of Defender of the Faith. And yes, if you're wondering That's why every monarch since Henry VIII in England has carried the title Defender of the Faith, along with the many other like 45 last names that the monarchs in England have to this day. In fact, if you watch the coronation, when was that? A year or two ago? I don't really pay attention that closely, but they did actually, in fact, use the title Defender of the Faith, which everybody kind of sotto voce laughs at because, I mean, come on, really? Still, they carry that title with them, even if it's just a formal title. So Henry broke with the Catholic Church because it would not do as he had asked them to do. Instead, he pushes for Thomas Cranmer to become the Archbishop of Canterbury, which he's installed there. And with him so installed, Henry convinces Parliament to pass what's called the Act of Supremacy, putting an end to any financial support that flows from the English treasury down to Rome, and at the same time declaring, quote, "The King's Majesty justly and rightly is and ought to be and shall be reputed the only supreme head in earth of the Catholic of the Church of England called Anglicana Ecclesia." That is the Act of Supremacy. The King of England is going to be the head of the Church of England. And so while the Archbishop of Canterbury would be sort of the administrative leader of the Anglican Church, and he still is to this day, the papal equivalent of the Anglican Church, what the Act of Supremacy called the supreme head of the Church of England, is going to be the monarch, or in this case, Henry VIII. That gets us to Henry VIII and the founding of the both the Anglican Church as well as the launching off point of the English Reformation. So, of course, there's going to be those who would oppose the Act of Supremacy or question the rightful authority of the king to head the church at all. And these would be quickly pronounced as schismatic or heretic, and they would be punished accordingly. And that was the case of one person. You know the name, and you should learn the story, Sir Thomas More. He's been variously called a man for all seasons. He was himself a good friend, a personal friend of Henry VIII, but he refused to swear allegiance and swear loyalty to the king as head of the church. He recognized Henry's office not only as the rightful monarch, but also as the head of the Church of England, but he would not swear to the fact that he was the head of the Church of England, nor would he recognize that any layman could be the head of the church on earth, nor change the laws of the church. And so Sir Thomas More stands alone and will not have his convictions placed upon the backs of others, nor forced to change his own. He's imprisoned in the Tower of London. He's tried. He is eventually executed. And this is something we can see just kind of rinsed and repeated throughout the rest of the English Reformation for the next 100 years. And his heresy is that he refuses to acknowledge and swear to the fact that Henry VIII is, in fact, the head of the Church of England. He declares upon his execution that he was, quote, "the king's good servant, but God's first." And so he meets his end at the hand of Henry VIII. Nevertheless, the Church of England has arrived, and after Henry, it was led by Thomas Cranmer, himself a rather shrewd politician within the annals not only of political life, but also of church life as well. Cranmer was a sympathizer with the cause of the Reformation, and with at least from the continent. And in his view, as in the views of several others at the time, Henry's break with Rome simply presented a great opportunity to the people of England and to be able to insert some Reformation thought within the growing, burgeoning Church of England at the time. So Cranmer seizes the moment, and he uses it to ingrain many of the Reformed ideas into this new, growing Anglican Church. First, it comes in the way of what's known as the 42 Articles. This is the way that the Anglican Church is going to define itself and define the faith as taught by the Anglican Church. It is later going to be reduced to 39 articles under Queen Elizabeth. That's coming later in a few minutes. It defines the faith, and then he also is the author of the Book of Common Prayer, which would, again, undergo many changes throughout the years of the course of the English Reformation. But in essence, those two things define in sort of a non-Catholic way, or positively stated, in a pro-Protestant direction, a pro-Reformed direction, the ideals of the Christian faith as taught by the Anglican Church. And so even there, Cranmer, though being used by Henry VIII to accomplish Henry VIII's purposes, is trying to seize the moment to turn the direction of the church in a reformed and better direction. He also orders the Bible's translation into English, he being Thomas Cranmer, and then he requires, he manages to get the king to issue a royal decree that a copy of the English Bible is going to be placed in every single church in all of England so that the people can come in and read it at any time. And this is a massive change, of course, from how the church had operated for many centuries before that, especially in England. By the way, as this is just there's a couple of these complete asides, but they're just really cool, little interesting anecdotes that are going to be sprinkled throughout this. So again, this is why you pay high value for this course. I just found this interesting as Justo Gonzalez was explaining that the various English translations that were available at the time and that come down to us as well account for the difference between why some of us recite the Lord's Prayer with trespasses and others recite it with debts. Yeah. If you are in the trespasses camp, then you are following Tyndale's translation. And if you are in the debts camp, you're following Miles Coverdale's translation of the English Bible. For those of you who are in the sins and not sin against camp, I don't know where that comes from. He didn't say. But I find it kind of interesting that even, 400 or 500 years later, the influence of Coverdale and Tyndale is so massive that it even affects the way we gather together to recite the Lord's Prayer. I just find that fascinating. That's free.
King James, Jeremy, is like 95% Tyndale.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right, and I'm going to rail against King James Version of the Bible here in a second, but that's okay. That's true.
I would rather have Tyndale too.
Yeah. But back to our story, all right? So Henry goes through some more wives, some of whom were sympathetic to the Catholicism, some of whom were not, some of whom were just completely indifferent, but he eventually achieves his goal. He gets a male heir, and he further manages to convince Parliament to allow the crown to pass first to his son, Edward VI, and then to his daughters in order of age, Mary first, and then Elizabeth. That's going to be important for a second. Well, Henry dies. Edward VI manages to last at least 6 years, and our sickly little boy during his 6 years of reign is, for the most part, positive for the emerging Church of England. He allows great advances for the reformers, not the least of which is the publication of Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer and giving the people, for the first time with the Book of Common Prayer, a liturgy in their own tongue that they can use, they can recite both for corporate worship as well as for private worship as well. So Edward VI, he lasts a few years. He's generally in favor of his dad's reforms, and he passes away from the scene. So as he passes away from the scene, we see his half-sister, Mary Tudor, enter into the scene. Now, it's important to note, while Cranmer and other reformers had achieved some success in bringing the Reformation to England, officially the Anglican Church was much more akin, really, to the Catholic Church of Christendom. And what I mean by that is that it was Protestant, in meaning that it had divided away from the Catholic Church and did not share the at least the ecclesiastic structure, the episcopal structure, accounting back to the authority of the Pope, but it was largely a civic religion, much like how the medieval church had been under Charlemagne. You participated in the church, the Anglican church, mostly because one was English, and that's what one did. You were a part of the church, and the church ordered so many parts of your life. So Henry's efforts spurred on the English Reformation, but only so far as it made what was Catholic Protestant and then called it Anglican. All right, we good on that? So after Henry and Edward's felicity towards Protestantism, if that was only sort of a transactional relationship in the eyes of at least Henry VIII, the English Reformation suddenly suffers a pretty significant setback in the new monarch, the devoutly Catholic Mary Tudor, now Queen of England. Now, Mary Tudor was committed to restoring the Catholic Church to England, and she was very vicious about how she was going to go about doing so. She restored England's obedience to the Pope, essentially nullifying the act of supremacy. She restores the feast days to the saints. She orders the clergy who had married under the act of supremacy to lay aside their wives and return to a celibate life. That must have created for some very interesting conversations at the time. But she's most well known for her violent prosecution of Protestants at the time. She had more than 300 Protestants burned at the stake and countless others who were jailed and sent into exile, many of whom fled to mainland Europe, and guess where they went? Mostly Geneva or Zurich. That's where they would go into exile. Many of these stories of the martyrs at the time were captured by John Fox. Now, John Fox was going to write a book on the historic martyrs of the church. He only just happened to be starting that project when Bloody Mary comes on the scene, and he starts to recount the martyrs of Bloody Mary's reign and publishes it under the title Fox's Book of Martyrs, which I would very much encourage you to read. But that's also what attributes Mary's new nickname, Bloody Mary, to her reign there as well. Cranmer is also among Bloody Mary's martyrs. She sent his case to Rome, where he was tried and he was convicted. He was held in effigy in Rome, pronounced as a heretic. And he watched from prison. I think this was part of the plan for Bloody Mary, to not only eventually execute him, but to cause a bit of torture along the way. He's forced to watch two of his main supporters burn at the stake. Those were Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley. And if you're familiar with their story, you know their famous line, as Latimer was having the fire struck to his sticks around him. He says that he hoped that they would light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. That's a great line by Hugh Latimer. And he looks to Brother Ridley and says, play the man, dear brother. Well, after perhaps grieved and broken by what he had just witnessed, Cranmer is forced into signing a recantation of his beliefs. But later he regretted having done so, and so he recants his recantation, which I'm not entirely sure how that all works out, but that's what he does. And he says, as he's approaching his own execution, as I have written many things contrary to what I believe in my heart, my hand shall first be punished. And so as he approaches the funeral pyre, he literally sticks his hand into the fire for it to be burned first, and then he, along with it, later on, meets his end in the burning at the stake. So, mercifully, Mary's reign comes to a conclusion, and her half-sister Elizabeth now ascends to the throne. Well, it appears that Elizabeth really does not like extremes. She had seen the extremes of her half-sister, Bloody Mary, and knew that she didn't want to see those continue, and nor could it last. But likewise, she rejected the extremes of the Protestants, too, and there were a couple of those, I suppose, at the margins as well. So she reduces the 42 articles to the 39 articles of the faith, articulating the faith in the Anglican tradition in such a way that both Protestants and Catholics could tolerate what would later be called the Via Media, or the middle way. So she tries to find a middle path through the factions of competing definitions of the faith, and seems to succeed in doing so. She also allows many of the exiles who had left and fled England during Bloody Mary's reign to return to places from places like Geneva or Zwingli Zurich. And with it, they bring along with them, as you wouldn't be surprised, the Reformed theology that's gaining a lot of attention and support on mainland Europe. One of those who returns from mainland Europe had been spending a lot of time, I think, with Calvin, if I'm not mistaken. He comes back. His name is John Knox, and he returned to his native land in Scotland. Now, there's an entire story with John Knox, his broadsword-wielding bodyguard history itself. A fiery individual by his own right. That's not today's lesson, but I actually have written a paper on this, so if you'd like it, I'd be glad to dig it up and give it to you. But there's somebody will remember the author, but the Mighty Weakness of John Knox, I think, is the name of the book. I want to say it's Steve Lawson's book. I could be mistaken on that, but it's a really excellent read. Anyway, John Knox returns from mainland Europe. He goes to his native land, Scotland. I just envision John Knox as this big, red-headed, burly man that's going to thunder, especially against the Marys. Mary, Queen of Scots, Bloody Mary, and Mary de Medici of Italy just rails on their authority and their ability to even hold authority, but goes on to provide a lot of reforms within the ecclesial order of the Anglican Church. And he refuses to follow the congregational model of the Puritans, but also refuses the episcopal structure of the Anglican Church and opts instead for a model of presbyters, and hence is born the early Presbyterian Church. And so he pursues this Presbyterian model of church governance. He builds it upon the Book of Discipline, the Book of Common Order, and the Scots Confession. Here's another one of those great little asides. Today, the Presbyterian Church also maintains the Book of Church Order, which is a lawyer's absolute dream. If you ever have to defend the Presbyterian Church, it's wonderful because you actually have their own code books that you can point to and say, here it is right there, and you can cite it in the law. It's wonderful. But he builds the Scottish Reformed Church, which ultimately becomes the Presbyterian Church that we know and mostly love today. And so, speaking of Scotland, it's important for us to get to Scotland because that's how we arrive at the Puritans. The Puritans come to us through our introduction to the Scots. Why? Well, Elizabeth, much to her disliking, is counseled by her closest advisors to execute her other half-sister, another one named Mary. Yes, there are too many Marys within the entire bloodline of Henry VIII. There's Bloody Mary. That was Mary Tudor. This is Mary Stuart. And so they encourage her to execute Mary Stuart, or Mary Queen of Scots, for her devotion to Catholicism, again, trying to prevent that from reaching back into Europe. But remember, Elizabeth is a woman of the middle way. She doesn't like the extremes at all. She views that if I'm going to follow into the same footsteps as those who've gone before me and execute someone because I don't like their teaching, that makes me a woman of extremes. I don't want to do that. And so she doesn't want to do this, but she ultimately yields. Doesn't like that she yields, but she ultimately finds that Mary, Queen of Scots, has to be executed, and makes John Knox happy because he had gone pretty heavily against Mary, Queen of Scots as well. Well, when Elizabeth passes from the scene in 1603, she doesn't have a direct heir. There seems to be some sort of family tradition when it comes to heirs being produced under the line of Henry VIII, so she declares her successor to be Mary Stuart's son, James. Now, that's pretty interesting that there's not an actual heir, and so even having executed James's mother, she appoints him to be the new king of England. James is going to get confusing to us because he bears the title James I in England, but he's James VI in Scotland, and so we'll just call him King James and dispense with any confusion between the two. King James receives the most agitation from the Protestants who believe that the Reformation had not gone far enough. In fact, they believe that the Church of England needed even further purification, and hence was born their pejorative nickname, the Puritans. So they needed to purify the Church of England and make it even more reformed, more holding to what Scripture commands. In essence, the Puritans believe that the Bible ought to be the source for both the believer's salvation as well as sanctification, and it would include the construction of society itself. It would be useful for the construction of society itself. And so it was a very comprehensive belief within the Puritans. They often superimpose themselves onto the covenant relationship with Israel. And as such, they believe that as members of that covenant, society should be ordered to bolster the purposes of God on earth. And more practically, the Puritans rejected the trappings of worship that had already begun to creep into the Anglican Church, things like priestly garments, the use of the cross, celebrating communion on an altar as if it were some sort of sacrifice instead of a supper that should be placed upon a table. They rejected overindulgence in all of life, including alcohol, and they kept to very strict Sabbatarian views. And quite importantly, at least for our purposes, they rejected bishops, but in their place, the Puritans were often quite divided. Some, like Knox, suggested that there should be presbyters or elders that would govern a kind of a locality, a grouping of local churches. But others wanted a solidly independent church, what would later be understood to be congregational churches, which we are one of them. And so you can kind of guess where we will find our heritage a bit there. And I don't mean to paint the Puritans in a bad light. I think there's a lot of good to come out of the Puritans, and I would commend your reading of most of their works. But there were some, and even still to this day, there's a lot of disagreement within the Puritans or the descendants of the Puritans even to this day. Regardless of whether or not you were Presbyterian or Congregational in your polity, they both rejected Episcopal governance as a matter of, quote, divine right. And they did so because it not only smacked of the papacy, which they firmly rejected, as you would imagine, but it also yielded too often in church history to the control by the civil government, as in the case of King James. John Smith, that's Smith with a Y, was one such independent Puritan. Now, when I say independent, I mean that he was non-Episcopal, non-Presbyterian. He believed the reforms had not gone far enough, including the reforms of the Puritans. So he was a purifying Puritan, if you will. He came to reject infant baptism, and eventually he baptizes himself using an actual ladle to baptize himself. That's a fascinating example in church history. Then he turns to his congregation and begins to rebaptize them as well. So he flees England as well for Amsterdam, and he and his followers become known as separatists. They go and follow the Anabaptist traditions, but they believe that even the Puritans aren't pure enough. And so they separate themselves from the Puritans, and they are then known as separatists. And they take on many of the Reformed beliefs of the Puritans, yes, but they then begin, you're right, to mix them with the Anabaptists as well. But even within those ranks, you can already see what's happening. There's disagreement there as well. Some rejected the pacifism and the refusal to take oaths that were common to the Anabaptists, which we talked about, I think, last week. And by 1611, they are returning to England and founding the first Baptist church upon their return, which, again, that is important, especially for for our personal tradition here. Well, upon their return, these particular Baptists, and there's a distinguishing there between particular Baptists who were of the Calvinist tradition and the general Baptists who were much more of the Arminian tradition. More of that next week as we talk about the Canons of Dort and the Westminster Assembly. But they came into conflict pretty quickly with King James, particularly with their reliance upon the Geneva Bible. Now, the Geneva Bible had become popular not just with Baptists, but with many Puritans as well, and especially with the reformers on the mainland continent. The Geneva Bible had a lot of margin notes that carried a lot of the theological positions of the reformers in those explanatory notes on the sides of the margins. But they also, within those marginal notes, rejected the divine right of kings and the episcopal structure of the church. And you would only expect that would be the case. So, guess who didn't like that very much? Someone by the name of King James. And so King James refutes those. He does not like those margin notes because they challenge his divine right to monarchy and also to his title Defender of the Faith. And so he does what his grandfather had done. He decides to do his own thing. He authorizes a singular version of the scriptures, which is largely the Geneva Bible, but they cut off the margins and eliminated all those notes within the margins of the Bible. So that is now known as the King James Version of the Bible. And while that Bible has had profound impact upon the church and upon Western civilization, this is again one of those little rabbit trails that's free for the offering here today. We as Americans should reject the King James Version of the Bible. Why would I say that we should reject the King James Bible? Well, partly because we reject the monarchy as proud Americans. We're very much a republic and a democratic one at that. But also because, guess what those separatists became? Those separatists later turned in the name Pilgrim. They came across the Atlantic. They emigrated to the United States, bringing with them, as depicted on a very famous painting, one that is about the size of this room hanging in the United States Capitol Rotunda, a painting in which they have open in front of you for you to make sure you know what Bible they are carrying, a copy of the Geneva Bible. And not only did they come over in the 1620s carrying their own copy of the Geneva Bible as separatists, not only sick of the Church of England, but also the crass nature of Amsterdam, they come to the United States carrying with them their Geneva Bible. And as the country unfolds, it becomes its own thing after the Constitution. And guess what the first act of Congress is? An order to print the Geneva Bible for the entire population of the United States here as well. So that's my case for why you should reject the King James Version of the Bible. That is not a very popular discussion to be had in some certain circumstances of the country, including the state of West Virginia where I came from. But it is nonetheless true. If you want to be a true patriot, you would support the Geneva Bible because only monarchists support the King James Version. Great language in it all. But the lack of margin notes is a problem. All right, that again is our free rabbit trail. Back to England. We have to fast forward through some years by the time by which those who had embraced Puritanism and those who promoted sort of this parliamentary order and authority over the king had more or less merged into a marriage of at least convenience, if not conviction. And their effort is to rein in the efforts of the king, both on behalf of civil society, but also remember Puritans thought that was good for all of civil society as well as church society. This eventually leads to what becomes known as the Long Parliament. And by the way, I'm skipping over some very big parts of the English Reformation, including a guy by the name of William Laud, L-A-U-D. He's a terrible archbishop that goes after the persecution of many Puritans as well. That's worth its own study. I've mentioned his name so that you'll at some point Google it and learn a little bit more about him. But we go fast forward to what's known as the Long Parliament, and this pits the king against the now heavily controlled, Puritan-controlled parliament that results in the English Civil War. By the way, this is also the era in which the Guy Fawkes Rebellion, or known as the Gunpowder Plot, is discovered, and they're going to blow up parliament with all the Puritan-led members of parliament within the parliament itself. That's discovered, and they prevent that, but that was going on at that time as well. But eventually, we come to the English Civil War, and if you know your English history, at least on its basics, you know that there's a guy that leads the opposition to the King's Party on behalf of the members of Parliament. His name is Oliver Cromwell. Now, Oliver Cromwell was a convinced Puritan. Evidently, he was a rather stubborn individual. He came slowly to his convictions, but once he arrived at his convictions, you would not be able to shake him from what he believed. And he came slowly to the idea of Puritanism and Protestantism, but he eventually got there, and he would not be shaken from his beliefs therefrom. So he leads the successful opposition to the king's authority and the rightful authority of the parliament itself, or at least to rein in the authority of the monarch. And as he successfully leads the opposition, he overthrows the power of the king. He works to establish a republic in its place, kind of foreshadowing what would come later on, but on the other side of the Atlantic, on these shores over here. Cromwell ushered in a lot of toleration for religious faiths, broadly Protestant faiths, mostly Puritan faiths. But he made a major misstep when he allowed the execution of King Charles I at the time. That kind of reignites some traditions, at the very least, or at least some feelings, latent feelings that of support for the monarchy that are within England. And so most of Cromwell's efforts are undermined by allowing that. He had become the self-appointed Lord Protectorate of the nation of England. He passes the scene, and the monarchy is restored under Charles II, who on his deathbed declares himself to be Catholic. And so James II, the son of Charles II, resolves to restore Catholicism to England, but the English rebel once again and push back against those efforts. You can see this is, again, a rinse-repeat thing that has happened for about 100 years now in the nation of England. And after that rebellion, they bring in a guy by the name of William of Orange and his wife, also named Mary. They come to the throne, and along with them, they begin to grant religious toleration to any who would ascribe to the 39 Articles, and if not pledge, but at least agree not to conspire against the sovereign. So they don't have to fall prey to Thomas More's convictions of having to convince everybody or to swear that they'll be loyal to the defender of the faith, the King of England as the head of the church, but they have to at least agree with the 39 Articles, and then also that they will not conspire against the sovereign himself. So that gets us to 1688, and that's the end sort of the Catholic Reformation or the English Reformation. The result is that Catholicism is permitted again in England, but it's not official. It can just exist as one of many. Protestantism, Anglicanism in particular, is the official Church of England, but others may peacefully coexist, although they're going to be in fairly minor numbers and, well, not politely recognized largely. In Scotland, Presbyterianism, thanks much to John Knox, is the official Church of Scotland, elevating Protestantism again above Catholicism in that formerly very strongly Catholic nation. And what started with the sordid love affair of Henry VIII and ended with the over-exuberance but well-meaning Oliver Cromwell resulted in a reformed England, one welcoming a Protestant church, a mostly reformed Protestant church, despite its frailties of its human leadership. In the midst of the English Civil War, Parliament convoked the Westminster Assembly to advise it on religious matters. And we're going to spend more time next week looking into the Westminster Assembly. But though there were few in number who were Scottish, the Scots have an outsized influence in the assembly, and that results in a confession and a catechism that skews heavily Presbyterian, at least more so even than Anglican in its approach. We're going to study that more next week, like I said, but suffice for now to understand that the Presbyterian Church and many other churches like it and other Reformed traditions that still they will still follow, confess, and catechize using the Westminster Confession and the Westminster Catechism even down to today. In fact, we too would have much to agree with that confession and the catechism. There would be points of disagreement on that. I think there would be probably friendly disagreements largely. But given the many times, including today, that we have seen the kind hand of Providence superintending his church throughout history, including in England, where you have a reprobate like Henry VIII trying to do for his own purposes something that is actually very useful in the annals of church history, but motivated out of something less beneficial. We've seen the kind hand of Providence superintending his church throughout that history, whether that's the imaginations of kings or popes or politicians, protectorates, whoever they may be. I thought it would be appropriate for us to end our study today by reciting together a portion of Article 5 of the Westminster Confession entitled Of Providence. And this would be good for us to remember for our personal lives, but also to remember that even in the life of church history, God's providence has carried forward a faithful remnant of his people and his church. So let's recite together, and we'll be concluding from Article 5 of the Westminster Confession of Providence. These are just two paragraphs of the confession. The most wise, righteous, and gracious God doth oftentimes leave for a season his own children to manifold temptations and the corruption of their own hearts, to chastise them for their former sins, or to discover unto them the hidden strength of corruption and deceitfulness of their hearts, that they may be humbled, and to raise them to a more close and constant dependence on their support upon himself, and to make them more watchful against all future occasions of sin, and for sundry other just and holy ends, as the providence of God doth in general reach to all creatures, so after a most special manner it taketh care of his church and disposeth all things to the good thereof. All right, next week we'll look at the Westminster Confession and the Synod of Dort.